You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Jody Dean, on her book, Crowds and Party. Also on the program today, Donald Trump wins big in Nevada. Marco Rubio has him just where he wants him. Cocky, overconfident, winning all the delegates without any endorsements from people that nobody listens to. Watch out, Donald. Also on the program. Also on the program, Hillary Clinton re-embraces the public option. She never unembraced it, but now is touting it. I wonder why that might be. And the Republicans in the Senate will not even hold hearings. Don't want to even hear the name of a nominee by the President of the United States for the Supreme Court. Apparently because he's a lame duck president, which would have started 3 years ago. So apparently, according to the Republicans, no president in their second term can nominate a Supreme Court justice. And according to Mitch McConnell, he's now implying that maybe even the next president shouldn't nominate a Supreme Court justice. Meanwhile, trade officials promise Exxon not to worry about environmental regulations anywhere in the globe. And Oregon passes one of the most forward-looking environmental laws. We will discuss why millennials don't eat cereal. Matt will help us out with some anecdotal non-data. And a jury awards $72 million. Or I should say, not to a single person, but awards a $72 million judgment against Johnson & Johnson for not informing the public that the talc in their talcum powder can cause cancer. Just another one of those stories, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to be talking to Pap about it, Mike Papantonio, about that story for Ring of Fire this weekend. And you should know, you can always subscribe to the Ring of Fire podcast by going to rofpodcast.com. You get 1 hour of the podcast for free, and we do shorter interviews there and hear from Pap and Bobby Kennedy. So if you're interested, I should tell you. This interview with Jody Dean, we pre-recorded, not last week. It was last week or the week before, somewhere a week and a half ago. We're going to get to the Donald Trump stuff. I mean, this was a stunning in its sort of breadth and scope. I think Marco Rubio lost every single county in Nevada except for one. And it is just amazing to watch. And I have to say that while it may be the case that I predicted Donald Trump was going to have an incredible impact on this race, I don't know that I was ever confident that he would win this many primaries or would necessarily become the nominee. It certainly looks, it's not over till it's over, but it certainly looks like he's going to be the nominee. I mean, it seems, and what's fascinating is to watch all of the excuses that are being offered as to why he won. I mean, the theories are all over the place, and they're fun theories. But at the end of the day, there is a reason why Donald Trump is going to win. There's basically two reasons. One, they had a weak field insofar as there was no one candidate that was going to appeal to 60% of or 50% of the Republican Party. And the reason why he's done so well is because the Republican Party, the conservative movement, loves the idea of authoritarianism. I mean, they don't think about it that way. They just are authoritarians. And they're nationalists, and they're somewhat racist, and that's about it. So it is... Michael, will you IM him? You keep... signaling things and it's distracting. What is it ever you want that Matt to do? Michael's a little out of sorts today because he's being attacked on YouTube by a figure from The Hobbit.
Sargon.
I don't know what that means. So,
I just thought it was a good Jeb drop moment. I'm sorry. Are you on IM?
I am, but you just leave the Jeb drops to me, please.
Yeah, okay. Why don't you let Matt, don't be so controlling.
Ooh, look at you.
All right, so we're going to hear, this is an interview I did with, now I should tell you that when she talks about crowds and party, Jody Dean, and I think we get to this, the party she's talking about is not the Democratic Party. The party she's talking about is not necessarily any pre-existing Communist Party, but a Communist Party. So I figured, what better way to celebrate Donald Trump winning, you know, he's the presumptive winner now, I would say, of the Republican nomination. It's going to be a while. They're going to hang in there. Certainly Ted Cruz is not going to go anywhere for a while anyways. And I don't know why Rubio would, because it's not like he's got anything else to do. He's not even running for reelection in the Senate. But he's just going to hang in there, I think, until, I don't know, until something horrible about him comes out because someone wants to make him pay. But so we figured what better way to celebrate Donald Trump than by interviewing someone who's calling for a revival of the Communist Party. We'll also talk a little bit about last night's town hall. Town hall forum with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in South Carolina, hosted by Chris Cuomo, right? It was Chris Cuomo who did it? That guy's just bulging out of his suit. Like, he's got big... I didn't realize he must be like a weightlifter or something. That's the only thing that occurred to me during that, that entire forum on some level. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jody Dean. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the professor of political science from Hobart and William Smith Colleges and author of Crowds and Party, forthcoming on February 9th, I believe it is, from Verso Books, Jody Dean. Welcome to the program, Jody.
Thanks so much.
So, all right, let's start with some... I've been debating as to whether or not to start with just some definitions so that people can really understand what we're talking about when we say crowds and party. But before we get there, let's start with this idea that you express early on the book emanating from Occupy Wall Street, and that was the notion that, in particular, Occupy Wall Street, but I think the idea, it's illustrative, that the left suffers from too much of an adherence to the what you call the fiction of individualism.
Yes, that's right. So you might think that's a strange thing to say about Occupy Wall Street, that it's weird to worry that it was too individualistic, because it seems like with Occupy Wall Street, what we had for the first time in quite a while were lots of people congregating in groups outside in public spaces, making demands and pushing back against inequality and Wall Street and corporate power. But one of the problems with Occupy Wall Street was this anarchist, horizontalist idea that each single person had to decide for themselves exactly what they wanted to do. And I think that this each person decide for yourself, each person decide, is this what you want? Each person think about your own experience and your own feelings and your own identity. That the repetition of that ideology prevented Occupy Wall Street from moving to the next phase and from building a more collective organizational culture. Instead, what happened was the movement tended to emphasize too much this anarchist or even liberal or capitalist idea, which said focus on the individual, focus on what each single person wants, not focus on how is it that we are now coming together and having a common push, a collective interest. And that's what I'm trying to push us toward.
Okay, so I just want to break that down. When you say this individualism hampered Occupy's ability to go to the next level, it's on two levels, right? I mean, one is almost sort of a pragmatic level, right? I assume in terms of the way this sort of ended up being a practice within Zuccotti Park, for instance. But also you're saying on a theoretical level, it prevented people from making the just sort of the broad strategic choices?
Yes, exactly. It's both things. So practically, right, you saw this, I mean, I saw this actually happen in General Assemblies. So, for example, as I describe in the book, I was at an assembly in Washington Square Park where the big question was whether or not the people in the park were going to spend the night there. We're going to, in the language of the time, we're going to take the park. So there were 1,000 people in this General Assembly talking about, okay, are we going to stay in the park tonight? Are we going to take it? Are we going to occupy it? Just like folks have done down in Zuccotti Park. And the police were, you know, starting to circle around the park. And so it was a real debate with real energy behind it. And a number, since there were so many people, it seemed like, wow, you know, we could expand the movement, escalate it, and take this larger, more public park. Well, in the context of having this discussion, a young kind of revolutionary guy starts making this great speech, which seems like it's going to get the crowd all excited. And instead, what he says is, each person has to decide for herself. Each person needs to ask, is this what I want to do? Each person has to make his own autonomous decision. And it completely broke the collective general feeling like together we're strong, together we can do this, and made everyone start thinking about, oh, is this convenient for me, or do I have a test tomorrow, or did I not bring all the stuff that I need, or is this, you know, a little bit more radical than I want? So it became a bunch of eyes rather than keeping the collective energy of the group. So that's the real practical level. And this happened in multiple different kinds as people stopped thinking about what do we want and thought, does this work for me? Then theoretically it's a problem because it prevents the thinking through of commonality, of collectivity, which is actually really necessary if there's going to be a collective struggle.
And how does that that individualism, I mean, how is that a how is that driven? How is that a capitalist concept? I mean, in that situation.
Well, I think the way to think about this is we live in a capitalist society. And in this society, there are emphases on individual choice and individual responsibility. So, and we've gotten a lot of that since the 70s, right? This is, many people like to talk about this phenomenon under the term neoliberalism or neoliberal ideology. But one of the cultural political and economic emphases that becomes really strong in the 70s is saying that people shouldn't rely on the welfare state, that people shouldn't rely on society to take care of them, that everybody needs to take care of themselves and have individual responsibility. You know, Margaret Thatcher important as a figure in this, as she says, you know, there's no such thing as society. They're only men, women, and families. So there's the idea then that there's no social collective that bears any kind of responsibility for what happens in society, that somehow it's up to a whole set of individual choices. When activists repeat that language, they're not challenging the system. They're just reiterating its ideology. But if it were the case that a challenge to capitalism would result from just our own individual choices, then we would see that. Right? It's not about our relation to capitalism isn't about us as individuals. It has to be about us pushing back with our collective power. That, I think, is the strong message of the historical left. It has to be collective. And that's what I'm afraid got diminished since the 70s in the last 30 or 40 years, and I hope that we can rebuild.
I want to examine that notion of the 70s, because part of that is also the not just this notion of sort of there's a responsibility for us to be self-sufficient, and that's a measure of ourselves, and rugged individualism that and I don't know what the history of that sort of meme in American culture is, but there was also the other half of that was sort of the if it makes you feel good or be happy type of thing, right? Where it's just the preeminent value is self-satisfaction on some level. I mean, is that sort of the enticement of that? You buy into the neoliberal project. In regard of, you can't expect society to take care of you. The benefit you get is that you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, I think that's right. It makes it seem like, okay, everything is up to me. I make my own decisions. And if something that comes from other people doesn't feel right, then that's something I get to reject, right? They're making demands on me that are not fair. They're disciplining me. I don't get to have a good time. So there has been a kind of left rejection of discipline as by itself bad and coercive. There's been a left, along with liberals, right? I mean, this is a basic view that liberals have, but historically the left didn't have it, of thinking that somehow if the group is exerting a kind of pressure on us, that's something to be avoided, to reject, that no, that's hurting my good time, hurting my pleasure. And that's been politically deadly. Right? If people think that anything that comes from going with the group is bad, then of course we will remain fragmented and individualized.
And I should say, just to sort of put that back on sort of a practical level and using and staying with that Occupy Wall Street illustration, you cite that speech at the General Assembly, And I think, you know, certainly as time went on, the General Assemblies and a lot of the sort of the subcommittee meetings became incredibly bogged down by individuals' sense of being in some way, their individuality in some way being offended, or their individuality in some way being stifled as an expression, which became also just an incredibly practical detriment. I mean, there was no, it was very difficult to say, you know what, for the sake of what we're doing here, a lot of individuals need to be quiet.
Yeah, I think that the problem that we run into is that when organizing begins from the standpoint of what does each individual want or feel or need, we will never end up in a collective. But if we start thinking about what is something that everyone wants, demands, or needs, what is something that everyone recognizes is the problem, then we can move forward. And let me be clear, by everyone, I don't mean really everyone. I mean everybody who is coming together as an activist, or coming together in protest, coming together in opposition. I mean, there's always going to be someone that you're going against, right? We're talking about political struggle. So by everyone, I mean we're in a context of trying to organize. How do we move forward? The way it's got to be is thinking collectively, not from the beginning point of individual differences. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen this. There's a cool T-shirt that I've seen recently, and I don't know if it's an official one or not, but it's a Bernie Sanders T-shirt, and it has it's really colorful, and it has a kind of outline or silhouette of Bernie, and it's filled with multiple different faces inside it of different people. And the slogan is, it's not me, it's us. And I think that's really great. I think that kind of captures what I'm trying to push here, which is let's break from thinking about politics in individualist terms, and let's think about it in the collective terms that we need to push forward.
You mentioned that this individualistic streak was a feature of liberalism, and that it was only in the 70s that the left, at least in this country, began to adopt it. For the sake of just moving forward, explain the difference between when you say liberal and left, because I think and particularly just over the past, you know, week, as we hear this sort of a broad debate as to whether or not Bernie Sanders has the right to say that Hillary Clinton is a progressive as opposed to being a liberal or whatever it is, just for the sake of clarity, define where you see that, what the difference is between liberalism and leftism, or of the left.
Yeah, I am using the terms in a way that's kind of not the the typical American terms. Right. I'm using them as the way that political theorists use it. So political theorists understand liberalism as a set of beliefs or principles that begin from the importance of the individual. And then the liberal theory will emphasize individual rights. It usually emphasizes the importance of rights to property, more recently maybe rights to free speech. And typically it understands social relations in terms of contracts. So a liberal is one who begins from the primacy of the individual and usually emphasizes things like threats to the individual, how to protect the individual using rights, and then will typically think about these rights in terms of something like property. The left, on the other hand, typically begins thinking about collectives. And these collectives in the Marxist tradition are class, and one thinks in terms of the class, but in more contemporary versions, one might think in terms of sexed collectives like women, or race collectives like African Americans, or even religious collectives like Christians or Muslims. But the beginning point is a social grouping rather than an individual. And then typically there will be a critique of the dominant culture from the perspective of the group, and then an idea of social change that emphasizes the interest of the group. So that's the primary difference that I think is relevant for our discussion, is this one between individual and collective. And the kind of collective I'm most interested in and kind of struggle I'm most interested in are class struggle, because I think capitalism is the primary problem we face.
And so when you say the individual is a fiction, it is not necessarily more or less of a fiction than the collective. It's just simply to make people aware that this is simply a choice that is being and it's not necessarily a choice from the individual. It is a choice by some to promote this idea because it leads to an outcome from them politically and perhaps financially that's beneficial.
Well, I think that's a really reasonable way to read my argument, but I think I may have a more extreme view. I mean, I should actually take your version of it, because it makes me seem more reasonable than I may be. But I actually really think that the individual is completely a fiction and a fantasy. So, and part of this comes from, I mean, there are all sorts of ways to understand this. So one thing is to think in terms of psychoanalysis, which emphasizes the fact that there's an unconscious. And so when we think about the unconscious, we recognize that all sorts of important aspects of our lives are completely outside of they're outside of us. So how we think, what we think comes from elsewhere. So this kind of momentary convergence of them in my psyche is really accidental, and to try to unify it is always going to be really fraught. It's always going to be really unstable. Okay, so that's one example. Another example would come from, contemporary health and diet culture, where people are emphasizing stuff like the gut biome. And they talk about how our biome, our gut is a host to all sorts of different microbes and organisms. So we're not just an individual, we're like a whole bunch of microbes all combined. So that would be like two different ways, one kind of psychoanalytic and one biological, to see, oh yeah, there is a little bit of a fantasy here to think that my singleness is somehow the thing that matters, that it's even as single as we think, that it's actually really not very single. Like, I don't have any thoughts that are somehow utterly unique to me. They all come through other things outside of me and then get kind of mixed up and come out of my mouth. But there's something really arbitrary about highlighting the individual as the locus that matters.
And it's to the extent that the concept has been developed, it seems that it would, I mean, I think I'm trying to express your opinion, to the extent that that concept has been developed and imposed, or at least, spread as an idea, it is to the benefit of people who want to retain more of the collective assets than we would.
Absolutely.
if we perceived ourselves as a collective. All right, so
that's right. Capitalism wants individuals. Capitalism takes value from breaking up individuals' work and treating it as something that can be single and individuated, and it gets value by keeping us disconnected from the facts of our collectivity. So you're absolutely right. That is a key part of the argument I'm making, is that it's in capitalism's interest for us to think of ourselves as individuals.
And so, all right, so let's move to defining crowds and party, because I know that some in our audience heard party and the first thing they thought was, here's the hammer to get everybody to vote for Hillary if Bernie Sanders.
Okay.
And I want to dispel people of that notion. Although I think that you would argue there are times where there is some practical reasons to be supportive of, say, the Democratic Party. But I'll let you answer that. But define for us what crowds are, and as distinguished from party.
Okay. So first, I look at crowds as a way to think about the movements and energies of the last 4 or 5 years of protest and revolution that we've seen all over the world. And one of the things that's interesting about the, and here at crowds, I mean masses of people out on the streets, but also crowds as they manifest sometimes in social media, like through Twitter hashtags. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about crowds is there are like, they are provisional beings. Like they have kinds of properties that make them act as a being and not just as an assortment of individuals doing something. In fact, they have qualities that are like beings. Now, what these crowds as big, multiple, heterogeneous kinds of beings, that they are like this doesn't give them a specific politics, right? I mean, we saw crowds in the Ukraine, and their politics have generally been considered to be quite right-wing and regressive and not things that we want. We've seen crowds of neo-Nazis and fascists going up against refugees in Europe. So the fact of a crowd doesn't tell us its politics. It just gives us the force of many acting in the world. That's why it's important for there to be some entity that will determine the politics of the crowd. And by determine, I don't mean it comes in there and forces the crowd to do something. I mean it presents the crowd as having a politics in another place. We might say, for the sake of making the argument easy, just like in the media. And so how is a crowd presented? Was Occupy a real force of people's struggle? Was it just momentary aggravation? Was it, hippies and spoiled students? There's always a battle about what a crowd is. And I think that the way we need to understand the party is pushing the best part of the crowd, which is its egalitarian collective intensity, in a left direction. So that's what I think of as the party, as a political organization that pushes the energy of the crowd forward and lets it endure.
And so the party is sort of just institutionalizing those parts of the crowd that are the most cohesive in some way.
Yeah, I think so. And then the thing is like, okay, so what do we mean by institutionalizing, right? Is it going to mean, does that mean like making laws about it? No, that's not what I'm saying. But I am saying giving it a kind of organizational structure to push forward. So I mean institutional in that sense. It doesn't mean like, so here's a crowd, now let's build a school. It means here's a crowd, how do we let its egalitarian collective push become more than that? How do we let it endure after all the people go home? How does it still continue to give a mark? I think that if we're going to make any progress with all of these multiple movements and protests, they've got to be able to endure in a way that's not just, oh, well, I saw this in the mainstream media and then 5 academics wrote a paper about it. I mean, that's a way that the movements get, they can't progress. They don't accomplish anything. But a party can help make them accomplish something.
So what is this? Does this party apparatus exist? I mean, how does this party take form? I mean, is it the Democratic Party?
Yeah, no, my students always say, oh, this is Jody's imaginary party. They kind of like make fun of it. I don't have in mind the Democrats. I mean, honestly, I have in mind the Communist Party in its heyday, not as an institutional, any specific Communist Party, but the way that communists understood themselves as part of a larger organized party with a literature, with all sorts of different micro groupings, with the potential to realize some kinds of goals. So I have in mind something more radical than the Democratic Party. I mean, the Democratic Party is a tool of capitalism. Right? That's the goal. The goal of the Democratic Party is to win office for parts of the capitalist class. I think that there is potential right now to try to make the Democratic Party more responsive to the interest of young and working class people, and that's with Bernie Sanders. But what I have in mind is not a kind of, oh, how do we reinvigorate the Democratic Party? Right. What I have in mind is how can we learn from, I don't know, let's say the Black Panther Party or small socialist parties and the history of communism to build a stronger, organized left political movement.
All right. And so if you're using those as models, I mean, what is the end game? Is it to have the Communist Party, the imaginary, party in your mind? Is it to have that party then ultimately assume leadership? I mean, how does it walk us through, like, you know, how this happens as we move through your argument where the argument that the individual is a fiction, that the argument that individualism is not just a function or a vehicle to edify, I guess, a capitalism, but that it is also prohibiting sort of a better system of organizing our society. And a fairer system. I mean, how does that move through in a practical sense?
So first let me say my basic audience I think of for this book are leftists who are concerned with how it's the case that the left is so seemingly so powerless. And most of my audience would probably be in the, U.S., U.K., parts of Europe, right? Why does it seem like the left is in this kind of condition of
or doesn't
failure?
Exist or doesn't even exist? I mean,
well,
I think
see,
is the argument.
I disagree on that. I think that the left is that group of political people who everybody else who thinks they don't exist, but the right's afraid of. Right, like the left. The one thing that unites the left is the left likes to say we don't exist, but instead, but the right really does think that we exist, and in fact, we know that we exist because we have radio shows and books and literatures and papers and debates and arguments and conventions. So we exist, but we're afraid to hold on to it. We're afraid to acknowledge it. We're afraid to organize it, and that's what we have to do. So I don't agree that the left doesn't exist. I think we're just not organized. My target audience in this book is the left, and to try to say, folks, look, stop holding on to this individual that's so fragile, that's so filled with its own things that it can never ever get. And if you recognize that the individual is a fantasy and a fiction that's serving capitalist interests, maybe you won't be as attached to it. So that's the first thing is said, because when I was giving talks from my previous book, The Communist Horizon, I would get these kind of individualist questions. And so I thought, all right, next book, try to get it to where people will stop thinking individualistically so that I kind of push that part of the argument. And then the next part is to think, all right, what do we mean when we're thinking about ourselves politically as collectives? What's at stake in that? How do we do that? And at this point, what I try to do is think, all right, when we're a collective, we do things like exert a kind of psychological influence on each other, right? That psychological influence might make us all more courageous. It might sometimes be felt as constraining. It might sometimes make us anxious. It might make us do things that we want or don't want. But if we start thinking through how we affect ourselves when we act and think as a collective and then take responsibility for that, then maybe we won't be afraid of developing stronger and more militant organizational forms, that we'll take a kind of responsibility for that.
And so, you know, we're not at the point necessarily of specific policies. I mean, I'm literally, I'm sitting at, you know, like a, I have my Jacobin publication of Radical Ideas for the New Century, where we're different proposals about, you know, of policies or just envisioning what a different future could look like. We're not at that point yet until we figure out how first we would want to reorganize and sort of reorient ourselves to the whole, as it were.
Yeah, I think that. I think, like, one of these interesting things about, let's say, left policy recommendations is who are they being recommended to? Are they being recommended to, like, individual people? Like, oh, do you like this idea, Jody? I mean, is it like a consumer item? Oh, I choose mentally to like worker collectives more than consumer purchasing societies or something, you know, kind of purchasing collectives. I don't know, the name of those is escaping me. So are the proposals meant as sort of individual suggestions? Are they meant as something for to try to get the U.S. Congress to pass? That's highly unlikely. I mean, so what are they meant for? What I think that they should be meant for is building some kind of larger, I'll say left or socialist organization in the United States. That we don't have yet an organization that can be the addressee of these proposals. I wonder, is it conceivable that, you know, as people read these proposals, that they could end up synthesizing and saying, you know what, there are four or five of these good proposals. These make for a great platform of a new working class or socialist party in the U.S. So maybe that could be it. But I think that we need to think about who is the addressee of these kind of proposals. Like, who's it for?
Do you think that getting back to that idea of, you know, acknowledging, okay, Bernie Sanders has proposals, let's say, that are at least more sympathetic, I guess, to workers, to classes that are not the top 0.01% or whatnot. But does supporting those inhibit the context for a change to happen? I mean, how do you navigate that notion? I mean, do we need to, we're building an apparatus on one hand so that the addressee of those proposals, I guess, and do we need to simultaneously, does capitalism fall on its own? I mean, does supporting the Democrats maintain it? I mean, how?
Oh, okay. So you're basically asking me, what does this mean then with respect to Bernie Sanders running as a Democrat? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, more or less, or within the context of what needs to happen. I mean, what is the position this collectives has, you know, as it develops to a Bernie Sanders, let's say generically speaking, running in the Democratic Party?
Okay, so What I think right now, and I'm going to make it specific about the current election, what I think right now is that we have the most incredible opportunity to have a six-month, at least, open discussion on the most mainstream level of the United States about socialism. I mean, my God, that's incredible, right? I mean, people would have never thought, even 2 years ago, that someone who's identified as a democratic socialist would run for president and you know, tie the candidate of Goldman Sachs in the in the Iowa caucuses. I mean, it's incredible. So I think, first of all, that it's important with this specific election not to lose sight of the opening that it provides. I think second, that there's also a real opening for a kind of opportunistic move on the part of socialists is to work with the campaign, not as Democrats but as socialists for Bernie. And to that extent, there could be some work in changing the Democratic Party. I'm also actually not particularly optimistic on that score, but I think there's a lot of likelihood for optimism of, if socialists are involved in working on the campaign, they can split off all of the young people who are really excited about socialism and say, look, the Democratic Party is not representing your interests. It has no interest in making university education free. It has no interest in making sure that the rich are paying their fair share. It has no interest in putting heavy constraints on Wall Street. If these are the things that you think that matter, we have to form another organization. So I think that it's not an either or, particularly at this point. Once we get to the point where we're really strong, then the questions would be different. But I think right now there's the opportunity to kind of be, for socialists to be parasitic on this election and try to use it to galvanize young people and draw them into what could be, I would hope, a kind of new, if not new organization yet, a new organizational milieu or new organizational mindset.
Do you perceive the structure of those organizations to be like the political parties we have now?
You know, that's a really big question. I don't know. I really don't know. And I think a lot of that depends on how the idea would develop and unfold if people find this, if people agree. Because I can argue all I want for, there needs to be a stronger left-wing party in the United States, and if nobody agrees, it's just fantasy land. But I think that globally we're seeing more people turning back to the party form. Like if we look at we look at Syriza in Greece, right? That party was formed out of a coalition of the radical left. We look at Podemos and the related parties in Spain. They're also a set of combined and allied parties. They've got a parliamentary system
right.
That's radically different from ours, but this does not. That still doesn't mean that our left parties can only be pathetic little factional parties. They could also pull together so that we could exercise more influence. Another thing in the U.S. context, which is kind of crazily interesting, I think, is noticing how influential the stupid Tea Party was. Right? In just one or two years, they were able to exert a lot of force on the Republican Party, but still remain a kind of understandably separate ideological group. So that option might be better for us, but either way, it still requires that the left organize itself enough to be able to say, here are the things that the left a socialist left wants to pursue, rather than have the leftists say, we don't exist, there's no such thing.
Right, and I guess that's at a minimum. I mean, I would just spoke to Jane Mayer this past week about where a lot of that funding for the Tea Party came from, and hundreds of millions of dollars in some instances just from a couple of brothers and the Koch brothers. But lastly, I want to touch on this idea of communicative capitalism, because we've in the past interviewed folks on neoliberalism and touched on the idea of how sort of social media in some respects is, and I guess I'm particularly sensitive to this because I've got a 10-year-old daughter, but social media is basically a training ground to how to market oneself as a product and all the sort of ancillary problems that come with that. What do you mean when you say communicative capitalism, and how does that play itself out?
Yeah, so first, by communicative capitalism, I mean to designate the way that democratic values like inclusion and participation merge with capitalism, right? So we're supposed to express our own opinion, and then where? On blogs, on websites, right? We're supposed to be all involved and participate. How? By circulating petitions among our friends and, you know, tweeting our support for X or Y. These practices have been, particularly over the last 20 years, pushed on us as a democratizing form of politics. This is supposed, I don't know if you remember back when Al Gore invented the internet, they were saying, oh, it's going to be town halls for millions. That
yes,
kind of
thing. There was a time that's how we were going to elect our president, I think, was we were all just
exactly.
going to go into a town hall on the internet.
Right, exactly. Well, what we have instead has been the a rapid increase in inequality, concentration of wealth, new forms of hierarchy in media, and the real attack and dissolution on paid work for people who do media work, like writing, television, newspapers, these things. But you've seen a whole lot of changes in the media environment. So,
and I'd add, too, I guess, it's just functioning as sort of some type of labor brokerage clearinghouse.
Absolutely.
With the sharing economy, I guess.
Yeah, right. And, oh, there's a Jaron Lanier, who writes about digital media, he's got a great line somewhere where he's like, you know, the sharing economy means that the many share and the few take the profits from
right.
it, right? Sharing isn't what the rich do. Sharing is what everybody else does. It's another way to talk about the expropriation of unpaid labor. So I prefer to think about communicative capitalism through that framework and much less in terms of, you know, am I marketing myself? I don't find that persuasive. I don't think that most media interactions for most people are ways that they market themselves. I think that they're ways that people are feeling part of a collective, experiencing themselves collectively, and yet capitalism is expropriating that from us, right? It's treating it as its own private property to mine, enclose, use to sell ads for. So So that's the way my critique of communicative
capitalism.
But
aren't the likes, I mean, aren't the things like likes and, you know, favorites, isn't that sort of like the, you know, fitting in with your model, isn't that sort of like, that's how you get your sales bonus?
Well, that's the way a capitalist will look at it.
Right.
Or we can say what we're seeing is flows of collectivity. Now, that might seem, oh, that's, you know, Pollyanna-ish, or you can say it's dialectical, right? That the same kind of process from a capitalist side is about marketing. But if you look at it from a collective side, then you say, hey, how come someone else is treating our social life, is treating my relation to my friends as something they make money from? That's sick.
Right. I'm not sure that they're... I guess it's just the scorekeeping maybe that is somewhat problematic, because that to me is what commodifies it and allows it to be marketed, right? Is that, you know, I've got X number of likes, and you know, look, I'm saying this as, I'm saying this as a guy who basically lives and dies on how many, how many downloads we get,
So on the one hand, you think about what are the many doing? What are the many like? What are the many putting their energy into? What are they finding? So that part is a collective part. Then as soon as it becomes a vehicle for someone to profit, it becomes individuated. What do they think about, you know, you, your show, you know, your particular item? But we don't have to accept the marketing version of this as the only way. What we can also say is, yeah, people find themselves wanting to be parts of collectives. And the more that we start to embrace and encourage that, perhaps that we can politicize it rather than just kind of keep pushing it into a capitalist framework. I guess what I'm trying to do is find ways that we're not cynical about the practices, and because I think our cynicism is our critique of the way our relationships are stolen by capitalism to use for capitalist profit. But there's another way that we can take these things back.
Well, Jody Dean, the book is Crowds and Party. We will link to that book. It comes out, I guess, within the week. And thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right, folks. So there you have it. Don't know that. I mean, it's a we've run the gamut today, right? We're going to talk about Donald Trump. I don't know. It's not inconceivable that in the general election he tacks all the way. He tacks left and just keeps going.
We need to make the Communist Party great again. It's true. It's true. I mean, look, 1930s, there was a Communist Party. They did a fantastic job. And now it's nothing. You look at it, it's a mess. You don't see the Communist Party anymore.
I mean, originally my theory was this guy does not want to be president, and we're going to see him. And still, I think there have been times. I don't have that sense anymore. But over the past couple of months, there were times where I thought, like, okay, he's just going to see, like, it's like one of those trading places, you know, bets. Like, I'm going to, he's sitting around in his limo and he says to his aides, watch this. I bet you I can say this or act this out. I'm going to act out how Ben Carson stabbed that guy. And we'll see how much will you give me if I do that? $5? He goes and does it and sees if he loses any support. It's not inconceivable to me that he could be in the limo going like, okay, Tuesday night, full bore communist. Just to see if they'll follow me.
The dream didn't die with the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's true. It's true. You can't have a classless world until the late stages of capitalism. You know, everybody says there's no left, but people who aren't on the left, they get that there is a left. It's true. It's true. We're doing a fantastic job. We don't even see it. The individual is like gut bacteria, man. It's a concept. The collective, that's real. Collective's tremendous. You don't build buildings with individuals. You build them with a collective. A faceless merging of the individual into the whole for a greater harmony in the whole system. That's communism. It's true. It's fantastic. It's a dialectic. Bernie Sanders is bougie. He's in a bourgeoisie accommodationist. It's true.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half. A reminder, this program relies almost 99% now, I would say, right now. The ebbs and flows. It goes from like 99.3% to 98.2% maybe on our members for its existence. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you become a member, we give you a bonus of an extra hour show each day, 40 minutes, 50 minutes, sometimes an hour and a half. So check that out. Also, if you go to majority.fm/review, I think it is, you can leave a review for us on iTunes. We got a really scathing review the other day that said that we were boring and dry.
You specifically.
Was it me specifically?
Yes.
Oh, you saw that?
I did. I enjoyed it.
Fair enough. I don't know. I mean, if they listened for 10 days in a row, I don't know why they didn't mention, like, there were one or two days that were more interesting than the others.
Well, I think it sort of goes without saying. I like when people, though, state those random, like, I gave you a 10-day trial.
That's pretty good.
Horrible.
I mean, I think
know.
That's...
I don't even feel like I listen to podcasts times in a row.
Let me pull that up.
I have it if you want it.
What do you have it? You have it posted on your on your phone?
On
that's your
Instagram,
it's your wallpaper
phone,
on your
Facebook,
phone.
Facebook wallpaper.
Okay, here it is. Droll and monotonous. 10 episodes in and the dull, dry political talk with no informative substance.
Wow.
Was too much for me to handle. The guests are hit or miss, but at least distract from Sam Cedar. Well, there you go.
Well, the problem, I would like to just say, all kidding aside, could Hayes stop writing reviews under fake names?
It's really embarrassing.
Chris, stop.
Chris Hayes posting out there. So, folks, head to majority.fm/review. Give us a review on iTunes. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Have you not tried coffee yet? I mean, Just Coffee? You should. Actually, we'll talk about this in the fun half. But apparently, ground coffee. You think, right, that people buy beans more than ground coffee, or that at least, I should say, the purchase of whole beans is growing. Not true. It's the opposite. The purchase of ground coffee is growing versus whole bean. Why? Because millennials are lazy.
Right.
We're going to talk more about that in the fun half. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this. Oh, reminder, tomorrow night, Thursday night, in addition to having a show during the day, we will be covering the Republican debate at 8:30 p.m. We'll probably start around 8:15. We've improved our system for this, too, so it's going to be great. It's going to be fantastic.
No, we're going to do a great job. I mean, we've done a great job so far.
We love the debates.
The numbers,
we love CNN.
You know, yeah.
We love the Republicans.
No,
they love us.
They're great people. Seriously, they're great people.
They're shifty. They're shifty. You got to be careful.
These guys know how to make a deal.
They know how to make a deal. Yeah. But they don't know how to make a deal better than us. That's why we're going to seal the deal. The deal will be sealed. We'll be right back after this.